What's up, everybody? We're here on episode 4 of Inside the Circle. I hope you guys are enjoying the video. We have a special guest today, Stephen Paya, former college All-American from Oregon State, former top draft pick and the strongest guy ever in the NFL Combine, still holding the record today with 49 reps on the 225 bench press. I wanted to bring him on the show because you heard kind of last time with myself and Chris Galippo, we're talking about being five-star recruits and myself going D2, but I want to let a lot of the athletes out there kind of hear his story because he went junior college and he went the junior college route. And with NIL today and how everything's happening with NIL, right now college programs have 20 scholarship offers. Now college coaches are giving 12 of those scholarships to guys in the transfer portal, and really the kids in high school are getting screwed over, and they're getting about 8 scholarships available for these colleges to go and give those scholarships out. So kids who used to be 3-star recruits that would go to big time programs are now going D1AA. Guys that were D2 guys that used to go D1AA, D2 are now getting stuck going JUCO or just quitting football. So I just want to kind of break the myth of D1 or die. And it's not just about D1 or die. There's so many different avenues that are out there for athletes to be able to get to the next level, whether that's college or the NFL. Again, myself, I went from the number one school in the country, USC, to going D2 and still having an opportunity to play in the NFL. And Stephen Paya, he's a guy who came from Tonga, moved to America, had to learn the game of football, never played. He played rugby and went the junior college route and ended up being a top NFL draft pick. So get your popcorn ready for everybody out there. We have a great story today of somebody who worked their way to the top. And it's all about hard work, right? I always say hard work beats talent when talent stops working. And Stephen Paya is a perfect example of hard work trumps everything. He was an undersized defensive tackle, but the hard work that he put in to his journey and his process not only changed his life, it changed his family's life. So we're really blessed and happy to have him here today. Just kind of want to jump into it. You have a very unique story, not growing up in America. If you want to kind of give a little background of where you were born at, where you were raised at, and kind of how that that culture and that lifestyle kind of impacted kind of who you are today.
Thank you, Jordan. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
So I was born in New Zealand, Auckland, New Zealand, and I grew up my whole life till I was 16 in the island of Tonga. And Tonga is a very small country.
How many people live in, but like kind of how big is Tonga?
It's a total of 100,000, okay. 100,000 people.
Wow.
And you don't have to worry about rent. You don't have to worry about, you know, it's one of those, it's the island life.
Yeah.
You grow up, my mom, my dad had a business, but it's just to, you know, pay, you know, workers and, you know, with their little business. But I was blessed enough to grow up in the islands because they are very culture, very heavy in culture, and respect the elders and all those things, like with the discipline. That's all I learned, all those core values when I grew up.
That's awesome.
In the islands, and be able to be on time to everything, be able to have respect to others, be courteous of others, and things like that. Respect your elders. All those things I kind of like had a background growing up in the islands.
Yeah, great core values. Yeah,
core values, and I brought that over to the States when I moved here.
So when you were growing up in Tonga, is it kind of like here in America where you just go to elementary school, middle school, high school? Is there high school athletics out there, or how do you guys compete for sports?
Yes, there is high school athletics out there. We have rugby and we have track and field.
Okay.
And I did both when I was.
What'd you do in track? You're a little big to be running track.
I did shot put and discus.
Okay. Yeah. Awesome.
And I also did rugby, but it's not over there. It's you know, we don't have the universities like over here. You don't have, you know, the colleges that they come and offer you scholarship and stuff like that.
So what do you guys do after high school? Is it kind of
That's the big question, because a lot of kids there, what they do is they go to Fiji or they go to New Zealand or they go to BYU Hawaii.
Yeah.
You know, when you have that connection and you have your parents or your relatives that be able to afford helping you pay for your education. And education is the key.
Number one thing, right?
Because you go and do your school you come back, work for the government, have a good job, and just live the island life.
Yeah. And we've had a lot of polys that came through our program. Mm-hmm. So I kind of was able to kind of see firsthand that lifestyle and kind of how they lived. Obviously, California is a big destination for a lot of polys. I figure if you're coming from American Samoa or Tonga, right, New Zealand, you go to Hawaii, you go to California, Northern California, Southern California, Utah, a lot of polys in Washington. Some of the polys that came through our program, DJ Galele, who's obviously top quarterback mm-hmm. in the country right now, his brother Mateo, Malaki Teo, who came from Hawaii, Leonga Lafau. And when I see Malaki Teo and Leonga Lafau move out here from Hawaii for their eighth grade year at Winter Circle, it is that island life. It's crazy, everything you say, right? The respect, the culture, right? All that stuff was there. And Leonga Lafau always sticks out to me. He was a kid that came over here to play for our football team, to go to school here, and he stayed with one of his cousins. Mm-hmm. And just a very humble kid, you know. He lived in the garage on egg milk cartons with a mattress mm-hmm. next to a lawnmower. Wow. And you see it in the videos he would post, like, damn, he's really, you know, he's really out here to make something happen. Yeah. And he doesn't need much. Mm-hmm. And he ended up being, after he left our program here, he ended up going to J. Sarah, kind of got homesick, ended up going back to Kahuku High School. Yeah. And he became the number one player in Hawaii. And he was the first player ever from Hawaii ever to sign a scholarship to the University of Texas, yeah. right? He's a linebacker there. So it's cool to see the poly culture, right? We know they always take care of each other, family, everyone's related, you know? Yeah. So to see them take these kids in from, you know, different from the islands and things like that, mm-hmm. help them out and give them a whole new world and a whole new opportunity. That's something that I was always intrigued about. And that's really cool to see about the culture. So for you, when you were there, what sport were you really taking serious in Tonga?
It was rugby. My twin brother, I have a twin.
Wow.
And he's obviously smaller than me, but he was the one who always pulled me into sports. But I was more like in the education part. I've always studied. I've always had made sure that I have good grades because, you know, that's the standards.
Yeah.
And for sports, it's like one of those things that I just took it as a hobby. And then I didn't know I could be.
Yeah.
You know, I'm blessed, you know, athletically and you know, like you're saying, a lot of kids, like for me, when I moved here to the United States when I was 16, I moved here with my mom. And a lot of kids that you mentioned that moved here, the biggest thing for them is the mental toughness, because we are so blessed athletically with our, we have that.
Physical traits.
We're fast, strong. You know, we're in the weight room. We're, you know, football players. Like you have attributes.
You build them in the lab. You want to build them like that, right?
But what's missing is the skills and, you know, the mental toughness of, especially when I was in Oregon State, I've seen a lot of five-star athletes, Polynesian, who come there and not even last 2-3 months because they're homesick and they leave.
And they leave. It happens all the time, right?
And those are the things that you don't train those. There is a way to, you know, get these kids mentally tough.
Yeah.
But that's big for a lot of kids who move, like you're saying, move out here and then go through that process and be able to be successful, is because it's really tough, that culture shock.
Culture, yeah. Because you got to figure 100,000 people in Tonga, that's just the city of Corona right here, you know. How big Southern California is. Our city has about 150,000 people in it, right? That's the whole region of Tonga, you know. So when you got to 16 years old, was there a national team for Tonga for rugby? Were you trying to make that, or did you just say, hey, someone came in your life and said, hey, you should probably move to the States to play football?
So that's why my dad and my mom planned, you know, to be for my mom to give birth in New Zealand, because of that idea that after high school, we're going to go to New Zealand and try at rugby.
Because they have colleges there, or is it just more
National teams? They have colleges in New Zealand.
Okay.
And then you'll be able to have a chance to go and play for the All Blacks. That's the national team.
For sure.
And there's no way I want to play for, you know, not that I don't want to play for the Tonga national team or whatever, but
New Zealand's a standard, right?
Yeah, New Zealand's standard. And they'll pay you.
Yeah.
It's worth it for, you know, for all the hard works you put on. But going back to what you're saying, I had my first cousin, Chris Momolunga, who lived here, in Los Angeles, went to college in University of Kansas, came to Tonga for a visit, business visit, and he saw me playing rugby, and then he was like, gave me the advice, you know, you can play football and you don't have to touch the football or run the football, and you can still get paid millions of dollars, because that's what he did. He made it to the NFL, had all his success. And that seed that he planted in my head, my mom just driven, you know, just
first thing, right?
First thing. Then that was it.
So did he go to Tonga to recruit? Because I know a lot of guys like Ray Maluga went to American Samoa, Troy Polamalu, right? A lot of the guys went out there and they started hosting camps out there to try to bridge the gap between American Samoa to get these kids to play college football like that, right? Was Chris going out there to recruit people? Was he just on vacation, or what was like kind of, how did he get back out to the island?
He was on vacation. He has his business. It was a business visit for him and his partners. But he came across my family and he kind of, you know, planted the seed in our head. And then the following year, we had our tickets.
We were ready to go.
We literally left everything.
Wow.
You know, school. I wasn't even done with high school yet. And
so what grade were you in out there?
So I was there. I was on I was 11th grade.
Okay.
But we're kind of like ahead, like a year ahead. Yeah. So we came here.
Because a lot of the Paulies who move out here, even though they're farther ahead out there, when they come here, they usually go about a grade or two back.
Yeah.
And they do that because they have to learn the language, right? Not only just the culture and the whole new fast-paced lifestyle, but you guys speak a whole completely different language out there, right?
Yep.
And that has to be tough to not only go to a whole new place, learn a whole new sport, but also communication's everything. If I can't understand what a coach is asking of me, right, the confidence isn't there because I just don't even know what's going on.
Exactly, yeah.
So how long did it take you? So when you left Tonga, you came out here. Where was the first place you moved to?
We moved to Lawrence, Kansas.
Okay.
Yeah, and like you're saying, culture shock.
Ooh, Kansas, like middle of nowhere.
Middle of nowhere, farms everywhere. Flatland. We had about 6,000 or 7,000 students in our
high school.
Wow. Yeah, and that's like, you know, that's 6% of our population.
Yeah, definitely.
And the hardest thing, so for me, was, you know, speaking the language, and I took an ESL class. English is second language, and I just started catching up, learning the game of football. It was big, and you know, because obviously that's why we moved here. But
how big were you when you moved here? Like, what was your height, your weight?
About the same. I 6'1.5. Weight wise, I was 245, 250.
Okay, about 245, 250. So cool. Now you're in Kansas. You're trying to learn the language. Was there any other Polynesians out there? Was it just mostly white people, black people?
It was a pretty good mix.
It was a good mix.
Yeah, Mexicans, black, whites. Okay. Yeah. But when you get out from your class and you have 10 minutes to, you know, get to your other class, you're shoulder to shoulder with everyone else, because that's how big the school was.
Yeah.
And another thing too was when I was in Tonga, we wear uniforms. And over here, man, I laid out my clothes Monday to Friday. Because, you know, we're excited. Everything that you see in the movies when you're in Tonga, it's here. You're living it. Yeah.
That's cool.
You go to the gas station and you get the soda that you like, the chips, you know, everything that you see.
So you guys just didn't really have that in Tonga?
No.
Really? Yeah. Was it like, did you guys have McDonald's out there?
No, McDonald's. We went to McDonald's basically, like, you know, every day.
Yeah, you got out here and it's like, dang.
And then you start realizing you're gaining bad weight. And, you know, we have our coach advise us on the nutrition side. But, yeah.
That's cool, man. So you're out here now. Are you in 11th grade? Are you in 10th grade here? Or what grade did you start off at?
I got there 11th grade.
So 11th grade. Yeah. You're 6'1", you're 245, physical specimen, right? You're trying to learn the language. What position did you want to play? What position did you end up playing your first year? Kind of.
So in Tonga, my favorite position is the number 8. And then if you're not familiar with the 8, you're kind of like a fullback, running back.
Mm-hmm.
You run the ball. I ran the ball a lot, and I loved it. but when I came here, I was 245, probably one of the biggest kid in ours.
NFL size fullback already.
In our school. And then I remember my head coach and said, nah, you're not running the
crush football. Crush your dreams.
We have 160-pound running backs that, you know, speedster, everything, you know, and they could be able to run the ball, like, consistently, you know. Mm-hmm. So they put me in tight end and defensive lineman. So,
how long did it take you to pick things up? You know, was it new getting in a three-point stance? Did you get training before you came? Like, kind of how did that gap bridge from rugby to – because obviously you're big, you're strong, you're fast. Now you have to learn how to do all these things. And I know we've had kids who never played football, kind of very similar stories as you, where, like, they get in a three-point stance. It's like a little Frogger stance. Like, they don't even know kind of what to do, you know? What was that? Did you have training before you came? Did they start prepping you, or was it just like you were thrown into the fire and it's like, good luck, dog?
Yeah, I was basically thrown in the fire, like aqua stance. The biggest thing for me was the helmet.
Yeah.
In rugby, you have your whole vision, you know, and then when you have the helmet, your vision is just like, you know, compact that you can't really see.
Got your blinders on.
Yeah. And for me, I have to get used to the weight of the helmet. The weight of the shoulder pads, you know, all these padding and stuff that you got to wear. And, you know, all we had in rugby is just shorts, shirts, and cleats.
Yeah, ready to go. No protection.
Ready to go, yeah. So in this case, you have about like 10 to 15 pounds of equipment you put on. That was the number one thing for me. And then after that, it was being able to wear that and get used to it. You know, with the techniques and everything, I picked it up, like, I think about a month.
Okay.
Took me a month of techniques, where to line up.
Yeah.
What do I do? You know, when the ball goes that way, I'm running after them, or I'm a tight end, who am I blocking?
Yeah.
So it was like a lot of things just, you know.
Did you have a Polynesian coach on staff to speak to you, or did you just have to pick up the language?
I just had to pick up the language. Yeah. But I understood some of the basic,
yeah,
you know, like door, cars, I understood all that, but to have like a full-on conversation, it was hard to have, you know, to carry a whole conversation. But when the coach is yelling at you, you already know what
yeah. Awesome. So you're there junior year now, you're playing tight end, you're playing what, D-line?
Defensive line. D-tackle.
So did you leave Kansas to Utah after football season, or did you stay there the whole year, then leave after the school year? When did you make the trip to Utah?
I moved to Utah right after the season. It was, I think, around spring 2005.
Okay.
2005. So we moved to Utah, finished my senior year there in Timview High School.
At Tempe View, right? Which is a great, big high school up there in Utah. Yeah. I'm sure it was a lot easier for you to make the transition from being in Kansas, right, to Utah, because Utah, obviously, big poly community, big Mormon community up there. Did you have cousins up there? Did you have family up there? Kind of what made you go to Utah?
It was a funny story because my older brother was dating a girl from Utah.
Okay.
And one day he was like, yep, we're going to Provo, Utah. And he made it work. And, you know, like we talked about it before, it just felt like God was just showing you the path, even though through people and through, you know, other reasons why you got to go to Utah. But we had to go to Utah, Provo, Utah.
So who was with you at this time? Was it you, your brothers, your siblings, your mom? Like who was kind of, who moved with you from Kansas to Utah?
So the whole time, it was when we first moved from Tonga to Kansas and Kansas to Utah, was my older brother. Okay. He's about 10 years older than me. So he was our parental guardian.
Wow.
While my mom was in San Jose working, just paying our bills while we're making sure that we're pursuing the football dreams. And then
what a huge sacrifice, right, for a family. And that's just... speaks to you and kind of how fast you had to grow up going from one country to another country, from one state to another state, you and your siblings pretty much versus the world.
Yeah.
You know, mom's living in California. She's working. She's in a new place, all for the American dream. Right. And that's the beautiful thing about your story. You know, so many kids here in America, in this area, they have it. They're blessed, right?
Yeah.
They have all the resources in the world and they don't take advantage of them. So it's always cool to see a story like yours where you literally picked up and left, came to a completely new place, and everybody sacrificed for the ultimate goal and the dream. And That was to give you an education and to be play football and to hopefully change your entire family's trajectory, right? Like you did. So that just speaks volumes to who you are and, and your family and the sacrifice and the type of person you are to be able to, one, be able to handle all that, but to be able to maximize that opportunity and do what you did. You know, that's super cool. I didn't know that about you. So now you're in Utah, you're playing at Tempe View High School. Did they change your position there? Did recruiting get serious? Like, kind of, what was the Utah experience like?
So Utah, I ended up just played, instead of playing tight end like I did in Kansas, I played both both ways, O-line and D-line.
Okay.
But I knew my favorite position was just D-line because I obviously undersized, fast. I was faster than our linebackers and safeties. And on our highlight, I'm tackling the guy, the running back, 30 yards down the field, and I'm passing all our, you know.
I'm sure that sticks out on film, right? Oh, yeah. D lineman who's running down the field, passing everyone up. That's cool.
And it was fun because that's when I knew. I was like, man, I do have a chance.
Yeah, I can play this game.
I've always had that that mindset that, you know, my mom always put that mindset. Ever since we moved, she already knew that we're going to play in the NFL.
You know?
Always put that mindset. And I think that was the biggest thing for me because after – when I was there in Teamview, it was our coaches and, you know, they have their guys that they
help. For sure, the kids who grew up there, right? Yeah. They've been through the system. They know these kids. They probably played youth football for them. They're at the high school program.
Yeah.
And I'm sure they were excited to have you walk on campus, right? Like, holy cow, look at what we have coming in. So did they really embrace you and your family and really help you with the development aspect of it? So when you were in Utah, were you like, did you have a trainer or a position coach, or were you kind of just training at the high school and playing for your football team? Like, how serious was your development at that time?
The development was just, I guess you just, it's like, for an example, for
like, D-line. Did you have anything like winter circle, or was it just
you just line up and you go.
Yeah.
And I kind of try to figure out the position. You know, I had my own thing where I line up and trying to time up the snap and just swing move, made a TFL. And I was like one of those things where I felt like all pro Hall of Famer in high school, right? Because I play against these kids that will never play again in college and whatnot. But yeah, like, it was just on your own. You learn the techniques, and then you get better by you know yourself.
Yeah, you start development. How strong were you in high school?
I not as strong as everyone like in my position. As far as
did you lift in Tonga, or was the first time you really started lifting when you came out here to America?
Everything was first time. We don't have a weight room there in the islands. We have the.
So how do you guys get so big if there's no weights out there?
It's genetics.
Yeah,
that's and the food that we eat is very natural. We have natural carbs, you know, starchy food, you know, all the protein, everything is fresh and healthy. So
that's awesome. So, okay, now you're in Utah. Now you're playing on the football field. You're standing out. You're comfortable. Did you go to college camps?
College camps? No, I did not.
So no college camps while you're there?
No.
Did you just not know, or were you just kind of?
I did not know, at number one. And number two, our coach there, they had their guys, like, you know, like I said, and they had the guys that they're trying to help out.
Mm-hmm.
So for me over there, it was just, okay, what's my next step, right? What's my next step? Am I going to go to, it was either BYU or Utah, right? And I even had offers from Division II to play offensive lineman, which is I didn't. There's no way
I play offensive. Yeah. So. Okay, so now you're at Tempe. You have a couple offers and things like that. Academically, how were you doing? Were you able to pass clearinghouse? Were you NCAA clearinghouse? Were you able to get the grades SAT, ACT, or did you kind of struggle in that part?
Yeah, with grades wise, because I went my first 2 years in Tonga for the high school. They did not allow any of those grades. So you're
behind 2 years.
Way behind.
A through G requirements. You didn't get the classes.
Yeah. So I did not pass. I passed SAT and ACT and all that. It was good enough, but it wasn't as, you know, really good qualified because of those 2 years I missed.
Definitely. So now you're in Utah. Academically, right, we don't qualify for clearinghouse, right? We don't have the A through G requirements because your first 2 years were in Tonga. You're on a team where they kind of already have their guys that they're helping get recruited. Yeah. All right. Now, you don't want to go play offensive line at a smaller school, right? So now you and your family have to make a huge decision where it's, what is the next step? So after your senior year of football ended, what was your next step? What did your process look like?
So my process was like, I still had that mindset. I'm going to play in the NFL and I'm going to find a way, whether I'm going to go to a, whether if it's Division III, the only offer, Division II, whatever it is, but I knew I was going to play D-line. But when I went to figure out if I'm going to graduate on time, I sat down with a counselor, school counselor. And for some reason, he kept talking about asking about my plan. And I was like, man, I really don't know. I don't know my plan. So he kind of gave me an advice saying, go to a junior college, which is Snow College. And the first offer that you get, try to graduate to get your AA.
Yeah, you have to have your AA degree.
Because that will trump your clearinghouse, everything, you know, when you get offers. And when you get your AA, first school that offers you, take it.
Yeah, for sure.
That advice came from a school counselor, not from my coach, not from anyone that advised me, you know, other than a school counselor.
Yeah.
And I sat there and I, you know, from this day, like, I've thinking back, man, that's like God just
the biggest blessing, you know,
putting the pieces through other people, right?
Yeah.
A school counselor was helping me, you know.
That's awesome.
With my path.
So. And you would think, obviously, that coach would be fighting for you. He has a special talent. He wants to get you out, you know. So it's really cool to see a school counselor really help you with a real plan.
Yeah.
Right? If you don't go D1, so many kids right now, if they don't get a D1 offer, they just kind of quit.
Yeah.
Right? They don't want to go D2 or they don't want to go junior college. They look down on that, but D2 has ballers, you know. Mm-hmm. Like, I played D2 on my team that I was with. We had 25, 26 Division I bounce backs on it. Junior college, right? Tons of junior college talent because guys used to, before you couldn't transfer, right? You'd have to sit out a year, go JUCO. So JUCO does have a lot of dudes. Smaller programs do have a lot of dudes, and you can make it out of any program, right? You have to have the film, you have to have the numbers, the accolades, things like that. Mm-hmm. But guys, coaches and college coaches will find you, right? Numbers stick out. So your counselor gives you the advice. You have to go JUCO. You go JUCO. Did you end up going to Snow where he advised you to go?
Yes, I did.
And is that in Utah or where's that at?
That's in Utah. That's in Ephraim, Utah, about an hour away from Provo, Utah, where I was at.
Awesome. So was it a good JUCO program? Did you know the guys that were there, or kind of was it another like, man, I just went to Kansas. Now I'm in Utah. Now I have to go learn a whole different other culture, a whole different new coaching staff and things like that. Or were you comfortable with going to Snow?
So I went to Snow, Snow College. My first time there, they gave me a partial scholarship. It was like just taking care of the books. And, you know, obviously I still have to prove myself. And I went there for my first meeting, and I went there, first D-line meeting, and I went sit all the way in the back. We had a seat assignment and everything. So I sat there and I was like, man, I'm like one of the, I guess, the coolest kid sitting in the back, kind of, you know. And I sat down, I said my name, and then the D-line coach walked in and he was like, you know, you're sitting there for a reason. And I was like, okay. And he said, this is your depth chart.
Wow.
And when I sit all the way back, you're a sixth defensive end, right defensive end. I sat him all the way in the back to the right side. So I sat there and it started getting dark because I'm like,
wow, I'm so far behind.
Number six on our defensive end on a JUCO, not USC, not on, you know, you have a chance to fight. But that started to clear up some questions. I'm like, man, is this what I really want to do?
For sure. We don't have that, right?
Right? I could have just, you know what? Forget this. I'm a failure.
I'm going back to Tongo. Or I'm just done with playing football.
Going back to what I, you know,
my mindset. This is a pivotal part in your career, you know? This is a pivotal part in your career where you figure, okay, I didn't go D1, right? I'm at a junior college. Now it's like, I have to go and really take this serious and I have to figure this thing out, right? What do I really want to do? Yeah. And it's so easy for kids that go to junior college or even D2s to go there. And when they realize, wow, they expect to go to JUCO or a smaller program and start.
Yeah.
These guys suck here. Mm-hmm. I'm not at a D1 school. I'm not good. No, there's dudes that are there. There's guys that are in the same situation as you
they're
that hungry. Didn't make it and they're hungry, right? And there's guys on the team who have kids, you know, who came out of different situation. They have families to feed. So here you are, you're at your junior college program. You're in the United States for what, 2 years at this point.
Yeah.
Now you're getting ready to go to JUCO. Your coach lets you know you're six on the depth chart. And now you're questioning the process, right? What allowed you to get through that time?
Man, to be honest, goes back. I started figuring this out later was why, you know, my whys.
When I
had that plan in my head, why am I doing this? Because I'm pursuing the American dream. I'm trying to retire my mom. I'm trying to help my family, my poor family going from an island. You know, I'm a known island to somewhere to pursue the American dream. When you know your why and your why is strong, like the how is easy.
It trumps everything. Everything
is numb. Like I go and work out. I just work my butt off every single day. Like I remember asking someone to buy me a sled with 245 pound plates.
Yeah.
And I left it under the stadium so that I come there at nighttime and pull it out and I start running. That's awesome. All I did. That the only thing that I can do was control what I can control.
Yeah.
I got to gain weight. I got to get fast. I got to get strong. And that's what I did.
And the dark times is what either makes or break us, right?
Exactly.
And when I was at New Mexico Highlands, when I'm at USC, I had all the resources in the world. I wasn't playing. So it's like, oh, I'm redshirting. I'm behind a couple first round draft picks. But when I'm now out of New Mexico Highlands, it's like, I got to get out of here.
Yeah.
I always say, you have to hit rock bottom and feel what that feels like in that dark time and say, I don't like this feeling.
Yeah.
I don't like being at this school. I don't like the situation I'm in. How can I get out of this situation? And you have 24 hours in a day.
Mm-hmm.
When I was at USC, I wasted those 24 hours. It's like, oh, I have workouts. I'm going that. I'm going to practice. I'm going to class. I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing, right? But then when you're in a D2 or you're in a junior college program, now it's like, no, I need to do more than everybody else is doing.
Exactly.
If I'm just doing what everybody else is doing, how am I ever going to get ahead, right? And those are the times that really creates the character, right? It creates the foundation for us and the work ethic and the mindset. When you're out there by yourself, running on the field, lifting in a weight room empty, and you're by yourself, that's really when you find out who you are. Do you love doing this? And do you want to do this? And your why, right?
Yeah.
So now here you are, you're at junior college, someone gets you a sled, is that when you become the physical specimen, when you just start working out every day and training and things like that? Or kind of how'd that shift go?
Yeah, so that's when I started to get into that. I was already looking forward to the NFL Combine.
That's
like,
awesome.
Even at the position where I was at, I was already looking like, I'm going to get invited to the NFL Combine. I'm about to beat the record.
Yeah.
So for me was, I'm trying to increase my bench, increase my 40 yards, you know, the things that I can control.
For
and
sure.
Everything that I, you know, with the football, we have the football training already. We have the weights. We have, you know, the running, 40-yard dash, and all the
vert stuff,
and everything. I had to do all that on my own.
Wow!
And obviously, they have staff there that helps us with our, you know, we have trainers there. But I knew that I just got to, like you're saying, I got to outwork everyone else.
Yeah.
And so when I was there, I was outworking everyone. I work out twice a day, and I go to practice, and I make sure that I'm eating the right food.
That's
and I
awesome.
Remember there, my mom only sent me $100 a week. That's my budget for food. How can you gain weight with that?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So I fortunately loved enough that I had roommates there that, you know, rich roommates.
Yeah.
And they packed up the fridge, packed up everything. So I'm over there eating their food, you know. They knew it. They knew that I was on the plan
budget,
too,
yeah.
On the budget. But everything that I had to do was going back to that plan. You know, my mindset. What is my goal? And then, you know, blindly just doing it without, you know, like anything that's promising me. Like, you're gonna get a scholarship, right? You're gonna get this, but. Going back, I already
faith in yourself, confidence in yourself that you know you belong somewhere. It's just a matter of time. And when does the opportunity happen that you could go fulfill that opportunity and maximize it? So usually when you're in JUCO, people don't understand. JUCO is, I always say it's like prison, right? Because at least in California, there's not much money. Like I see 8 to 10 guys living in a 2-bedroom apartment before just on mattresses, out here. It wasn't really nice JUCOs. It is a grind. Everyone's there for themselves. Everyone's trying to get out of that situation. Everyone has a chip on their shoulder, mm-hmm. and they're trying to make it to the D1. And everyone has a reason why they didn't make it D1 out of high school, you know? So how did you, when you were at that school, you said you were fortunate enough to have good roommates. Did you have like a support system, a family that was out there outside of your immediate family? But was there like a coach that took care of you, or was there a trainer, or was it just kind of you on your own and you just had to figure things out?
It was just me and my whole mindset, because I didn't have my dad around.
Yeah.
Because when we moved here from Tonga, he was never around.
So he stayed in Tonga?
Stayed in Tonga. My father figures were my coaches.
Yeah.
And the D-line coach, his name is Jason Ayu. He's with BYU now, and he does like players development in BYU. But he was my defensive line coach, and he was always on me, and he was always impressed with my numbers. When I first got there, they do little combine drills, mm-hmm. where they put down all your numbers and stuff. So my freshman year, I did 27 reps,
yeah.
of 225. They do 225, run a 4.75, 40. And then the second year, I did 35 reps.
Wow. So you already had those numbers.
So I'm hitting those numbers. Yeah, and he's like, and remember, the first year, I redshirt.
Okay.
Redshirt my first year. But going to, you know, your question, if I had the support, the only support I had was my defensive line coach.
Yeah.
Because he knew I was naturally gifted. But from the standpoint from our head coach was not to play me on the first year, save me for second year, develop so that they have older guys, mm-hmm. sophomores.
That they're trying to get out.
They're trying to get out.
And they always do that JUCO. They'll bring guys in, they'll redshirt them because they have a pecking order of guys that they're trying to help. Mm-hmm. And it's like, your plan was probably redshirt, and they get 2 years out of you there,
exactly,
right? Because they want you to win, obviously, games also. So you come in, you redshirt. The plan is for you to stay there 2 years. But second year, so you have your redshirt year, then you play that next year. Did you just have a breakout year?
So you're asking that. I was not a starter.
Wow.
My second year. I was a second string D tackle now. So I went from
six to, yeah.
Yeah, because the guy in front of me, they're trying to start him to get, you know, playing time to go. But for me, I started talking to Oregon State.
Mm-hmm. How'd that relationship happen? Camps, or was it just...
So the guy who was in front of me the year before, you know, obviously there was a bunch of them. He went... he's my friend now, good friend now. His name is Sioli now. He went to Oregon State right after that year.
Okay.
He went to Oregon State, got offered, and the coach there, Joseph Malo, D-line coach, asked him...
Is that Big Joe who's at Oregon and not Miami? Bald head guy?
Oh, no.
No, okay.
He's with Arizona now. Mm. He's a defensive line. His son is Isaac Simalo with the Steelers. He used to play for the Eagles. Anyway, he asked Sioli, who can you... What do you think of this kid? He was asking about the kid who started in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, don't worry about him. Look for the Paya kid. Mm. About me. They're hiding him. He's a hidden gem.
Yeah, there you go.
And in that time, I only had 8-9 reps on my redshirt freshman year.
Yeah.
And I remember I made sure those 8-9 reps were plays. Pancakes, yeah. Or like, right? Because I just remember I go out there, they're tired. Oh, perfect. So that was my resume.
And that's perfect. We always say, don't count your reps, make your reps count.
Exactly.
So many kids try to count their reps and try to, okay, how many reps am I getting this or that? It doesn't matter. If you make every single rep count on the field and you're making plays every time on the field, that one rep you got is going to be two. That two is going to end up to be three, right?
Yeah.
And that comes down to you having film, right? So you could have 50 reps in a game and not make a play, or you could have 10 reps in a game and it's like, dang, this guy's a monster, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's a perfect example for these kids that are out there who always worry about reps and how many reps am I getting and who's in front of me. It doesn't matter. When you get your opportunity, you just have to make the best of your opportunity, right? So you're here now, you're redshirt freshman. Now you get your 8 plays, Oregon's looking at you. What's kind of the next step from there?
So the next step was for me to... when Coach Joseph Simalo came over to Ephraim, Utah, he advised me, if you can graduate early on time during that season, they can offer me a scholarship.
Wow.
At redshirt freshman, so I could be redshirt sophomore.
And get the hell out. You got 3 years at Oregon.
And this was all behind closed doors. The coach, head coach, didn't know.
They don't want you to do it.
They're about to offer a backup defensive tackle.
Mm.
So I'm over here. I'm like, okay, I need 21 credits. I need to graduate by December because I'm going to go spring ball in Oregon State. So what I did was, back in Tonga, I remember I told you I was in with education.
Yeah.
I was really good in math.
Mm-hmm.
So I ended up took like about 5 math classes.
Wow.
About like, I think it was algebra, geometry. And those classes, like, I've already done all those classes in Tonga. Our education is really ahead. That what I did was going to class, turn in the home, did the homework in class, turn it in so I don't forget. So I had about 21 credits of.
And people out there who don't understand, 21 credits in JUCO, 3 credit classes. So that's 7 classes that needed to be take, be able to go and be able to leave early from JUCO and go D1. So you're talking about taking a full year of classes in one semester to be able to make that opportunity for himself and be able to go to Oregon State, right? And that again goes back to the mindset and the dedication where he was willing to sacrifice so much, do a full year of classes in 1 year, right, to be able to get out and maximize that opportunity, which is huge, man.
Yeah, and I remember going back instead of me going to my football counselor there, I went to a school counselor because I'm trying to figure out if I can graduate on time, and I don't want my head coach to know. I don't want my football counselor to know.
Because they will literally try to block that. They don't want you to leave because they need you there for that extra year. Yeah. Their thing is timing, right? And that's the selfish part about a lot of JUCO coaches or even D2 coaches. They'll redshirt you just so they have you for 3 years, right? And smart move by going behind the coach's back to be able to do that, because I'm sure if you didn't, they would have tried to say, no, you can't do this, you can't do that.
Yep. And I remember seeing him, the counselor, like every week I go there and make sure that I'm on track to graduate. And then the 5th week that I go there, the counselor was like, Steven, you're going to graduate. Just pass all your classes.
Yeah, exactly.
Before I even sit down. Oh, are you sure? Like, you know, I was just paranoid. I have anxiety. I got to make sure that I graduate.
I don't want this opportunity to go away. This is life changing.
Yeah.
That's awesome. So you pulled it off, right? 7 classes in 1 semester. So you got offered by Oregon State without even being the starter?
No.
Wow. And that kind of happens sometimes at JUCOs because of that situation. They know they got a talented guy. So you leave after your redshirt freshman year in college. So do you enroll in January? Do you go in summertime?
Yeah, January. So this is what happened. I went to Oregon State for my visit, also to sign a scholarship. And I remember on my way up in the elevator to sign my scholarship, my head coach for Snow was calling me because it's been 2 weeks. After our break, we're supposed to get back to our football for, I would be a redshirt sophomore. So he's calling me, Steven, where are you at? You've been missing our second meetings in a row. You're going to be the team captain. You have all these, offers, everything you can't be doing this. This is a big year for you.
Their plan isn't your plan.
And right? I remember telling him, coach, I'm actually here in Oregon State about to sign my scholarship.
Yeah.
And he connected with the football counselor, Claudia.
Mm-hmm.
And Claudia was like, Steven, I'm looking here at the transcript. How did you do that?
You know what I mean? Like, for sure.
I'm sitting here, I'm like, man, it was like the best feeling in the world when you prove people wrong.
100%. Right?
And especially you do it with in the right way.
Exactly.
And I remember I thanked them. There was nothing against them. And I think, thank you guys for opportunity.
For everything,
because the reason why I'm here, you guys took an opportunity, even though that I didn't finish over there, but I'm over here about to sign a scholarship.
Yeah. Do you think they would have tried to block you if they would have known, huh?
They would have known, yeah.
That's the crazy thing. And I've seen that before with college coaches where it's like they will literally block your opportunity because they want to move up by having the best team in JUCO.
Exactly.
And it's like your timing and your plan for your guys' program isn't my plan, right? And it's like it's sad to see those – not saying, right? It's sad to see people really to block blessings because they're being selfish themselves. Yeah. But as a JUCO coach, you got to understand your job is to get these guys out, not to keep them in your program.
Exactly. Get them ready for the next level. Yeah.
So awesome. So you sign your scholarship. Do you leave that spring or do you wait till June to leave?
I left early.
I'm out of here.
When I signed that scholarship, I was already moving out from my apartment.
Yeah, I drove my car up there, right? Wow, that's awesome. Yeah.
I remember staying with my D-line coach for that month before I go into spring ball. Yeah.
So. That's awesome. All right, so now, boom, we go from New Zealand to Tonga to Kansas to Utah. dad isn't around, mom's in California working. You're pretty much on this journey with yourself and your brothers. Was your twin brother with you the whole time or no?
My twin brother and my younger brother.
Okay.
And my older brother. My older brother was our parental guardian.
Yeah. But you guys are all taking care of each other, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So when you're done with JUCO, how old are you at this time? 18? 19?
I think 19.
So you're about 19 years old now, going to Oregon State. How was the transition from JUCO to Oregon State? Because you said you liked Oregon State. One, it was the first offer for you, but it was a great opportunity, right? Because they had a lot of guys leaving.
Yeah. A lot of seniors left, defensive linemen that left. And it was the best opportunity for me because the D-line coach, Joe Samala, already planted that in my head. You're going to be a starter. And when you come here, you got to prove yourself to be a starter. And then you're going to, you know, obviously no job is safe.
Yeah.
So when I got there, going from a backup, a sixth defensive end to backup D tackle to a starter in the Pac-10, right?
Wow.
It's like crazy.
Come true. Yeah. You know, it happened very fast.
Just a step closer to the NFL, right?
Yeah. Now you're really tasting it now. Yeah. Now you can really see, exactly, right? Because guys that you're around now are getting drafted to the NFL, right? JUCO, no one's there going to the NFL. You're just trying to get to college, right? So you have those building blocks, and now you're at Oregon State. Holy cow, I'm getting ready for my upcoming year. You're in summer training camp now. So you move from DN to what, 3-tech or nose, or where'd they have you at?
Both.
A little bit of both. Yeah. How big were you at that point? Were you
at that point? I was 290.
So about 290 now. Were you ever, right? Did you ever question yourself? You know, and it's like, do I belong here? I'm playing versus SC, right? I'm sure a lot of polys, they always look at SC, you know, as like the glorified program. Were you kind of nervous about that? Were you excited? Did you know you belong? Were you still trying to figure out who you were?
No, for me, I've always had that chip on my shoulder. You know, every time I play big schools, I have to perform my best.
Yeah.
Because everyone's watching. And not only that, when you're undersized, you're already, disadvantaged.
Sure. Yeah.
So what else are you going to go out there? You're going to go out there and get double team and block.
Yeah, no.
You know, so that's why I worked on my strength. That's why I worked on my speed, getting off the ball and skills, because I, you know, going out there undersized, going against 6'7", 330 pounds, double team, you have to stay low. You have to take on those, right? But for me, it was just like, you know, it was more like that David versus Goliath.
100%.
Like, you know, and that and mentality, I've always had that.
Yeah.
Especially being an undersized
defensive. And the reason why I ask is, it's so rare, do you see, like, how many starts did you have underneath your belt, right? Like, high school you played, right? But you go to JUCO, like, did you ever start a game before you got a scholarship to Oregon State? No. Or were you always a backup?
Backup. Always a backup.
Yeah. That's just insane to go and never start a football game, get a scholarship to Oregon State, right? And did you end up starting your first year there? Or?
Oh, I started in the spring ball. Seeing my name on the depth chart, when he came out and wrote our name down at Oregon State, it was like, literally, I looked at it, everything like flashback from my, I'm in high school,
seen it all,
junior college, everything, just like soak it all in, right?
Yeah.
But I knew that wasn't it. I still have bigger, there's the journey is still, you know, continuing.
100%.
I'm still like working towards my goal, you know.
And now that your name's there, you're never going to let somebody take that name down and put you back down to sixth string, right? That's awesome, man. What a good story. So, cool. You're at Oregon State now. You started the spring game. You're going into fall season. What was the first game that you played starting in the Pac-10? Do you remember? Kind of first time running out the tunnel and.
I don't remember, but I remember my first big game was at Penn State.
Man, they were good back then because they were in the Rose Bowl that year.
Yeah. It was, I remember going out there and play there.
In the freaking, all white.
I remember we got smoked. It was bad. And I remember our D-line coach was cussing us out. And the crazy thing, I couldn't hear him.
Yeah, so loud. 120,000 people.
We are.
Happy Valley. Yeah, that's the biggest stadium. Then Michigan, right? Wow.
Crazy.
So now you're there. You're starting. How many years did you end up playing at Oregon State?
I played 3 years.
Okay.
But the transition that when I kind of had the NFL conversation was after my first year there, my sophomore year, because I had two seniors, Deanne, there that were looked at by scouts. Mm. So when the scouts came in and watched their film, they're asking the coach, who's 54? Who's this guy? That was my number, 54. Who's 54? And then I remember one time, it was a spring, the following spring, after my sophomore year there at Oregon State, my coach pulled me to the office, and I thought I was in trouble.
Yeah.
And I remember talking with him, and he's like, Steven, we have scouts here looking at Slade and Victor, the 2DN, and they're asking about you more than they're asking, you know, about them.
The other guys,
because those two end up got drafted, I think, sixth or seventh round.
Wow.
But they were asking about me because I undersized, but I was just
making plays,
penetrating, like, for them. You know, they're making plays too, but it's because I'm taking two, you know,
And right there, because you're already 3 years removed from high school, you redshirted at JUCO, you played, now you're there, you're a redshirt sophomore year. You could have left to the NFL, right?
Yeah.
What made you stay 2 years instead of leaving early? Was it just you enjoyed being in college, or did you just feel like you still needed to develop before you went, or you wanted to make sure you secured a top draft spot?
Exactly. I felt like I needed to develop more.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my draft stock needs to keep going up. And I remember if I were to go after that redshirt sophomore, I would have been like, I would say
fourth, fifth round. Yeah.
And then the following year, you know, that's when I started getting to more Pac-10.
Your senior year, you got Pac-10 Defensive Player of the Year?
My senior year.
Senior year you did, right?
Yeah.
Wow. So you get Pac-12. So you're 3 years at Oregon State. You end up getting Pac-12 or Pac-10 back then, Defensive Player of the Year, All-American. What was for you, what was the biggest game in college football you remember playing? What was like the game you just, your coming out party, right? We all remember that game.
It was both Oregon and USC, but it was USC when they came up. You guys came.
We came up, so we're number one in the country. You guys had the Jaquizz Rogers and Rogers
James
brother.
Rogers. Yeah,
Halloween Day, I think it was up there, the fog game, and you just dominated us.
Yeah, it was. I had a really good game because I made a TFL off of Tyron Smith, We were named after that Giant Killers. We had shirts and everything. It was like we knew that we're never going to make it to the Rose Bowl and all that. But this is our championship.
That was, right? Yeah. And Pete Carroll used to always say, everyone's going to play you guys like it's the national championship because you guys are your SC, your number one team in the country.
Yeah.
And we got popped. We got popped by you guys, and we got popped by Oregon the year before.
How many first-rounders do you guys have that year?
That year you had Clay Matthews went first round, Brian Cushing went first round, Ray Maluga was player of the year, but he ended up going second round, should have been a first round draft pick.
Mark Sanchez
went first round. Yeah. Sheesh.
You guys had a bunch of O-line, Tyrone, right?
Tyrone was a first round draft pick. Lawrence Jackson was a first round. Keith Rivers was a first round. Like, that was one of the best teams SC ever had.
That was our highlight. That was the highlight of my career because it was like, you know, captain, you know, being in that team, it was just an underrated team, underdog team, where we're like playing against all these guys. We lose to like the average team,
and you guys beat the best teams. I know, that's crazy.
So
that's awesome. So here you are now. You're the best player in the country at your position. You get invited to the biggest All-Star game, right? The Senior Bowl.
Senior Bowl. Yeah.
So talk about your Senior Bowl process, right? You finish up. You pick your agent. I guess we go there. How was picking an agent, right? Because a lot of people don't know how that works out.
Yeah.
Picking the right agent is huge, right? Do you feel like you picked the right agent? Did they help you how you needed to? Or is there any regrets kind of going through that process?
No, not really. My agent was Dave Dunn and Austin Lyman with Athletes First.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why I picked them is because, you know, my head coach at that time, Mike Riley, that was his agent.
Right.
And for me, I just felt comfortable. I met them a couple of times and I just felt comfortable with them. You know, he comes in and just California outfit, shorts.
And Austin Lyman, I went to school with him at SC. He was in my fraternity, and it's crazy. He had to be maybe like 24 years old at that time. So he was a workhorse. And he was the guy they always say, you call Austin if you need anything.
Yeah. He's great guy. I enjoy being, you know, in the Athletes First. got treated right, and I've been with other Athletes First clients, mm-hmm. you know, Ryan Kerrigan, Von Miller, all these, you
it's
know.
It's a big family. The best guys go with them,
yeah.
That's awesome. So now you signed with the agent. Where'd you do your combine training at? Was it Exos, or where'd you end up going for that?
So I came here to Velocity in Irvine.
Okay, yeah, went to that location.
The location. And just getting ready for the Senior Bowl.
So the Senior Bowl was first, right? You went to the Senior Bowl, then did your combine training?
Yeah.
So talk about like your Senior Bowl experience for you. Because at this point, were you a top 10 draft pick they're projecting you, or?
Yeah, so coming out, Mel Kiper had me at number 10 on ESPN board draft, mock draft. And Von Miller was with me, and
Irvine. That was a crazy class, yeah.
And I remember him and me training at, you know, in Velocity, getting ready for the Senior Bowl. And we were like, man, we're about to go out there and kill it, get our draft picks up, go in the Senior Bowl, just, you know, do your thing.
Yeah.
That was the plan. And I remember going into the Senior Bowl, first practice, tore my meniscus.
Mm.
Right.
And what was it? Just a weird movement, or was it kind of just a play double team?
I remember making a rip move during team. It was like the first team where, you know, versus I think it was like 7-on-7 or 11 or something like that. But I remember making a rip move, and I planted my right foot down, and I just felt like I've never had that feeling before.
Yeah.
Disconnected, numb feeling. And I was like, it felt weak too. Knee was kind of wobble a little bit.
And you know your body, you know something's off.
Yeah, and I kept playing through. I remember finishing practice, mm-hmm. you know, finished the practice. But I remember standing there, and I knew when after like 20 minutes after that feeling, adrenaline came down a little bit, and I knew that I hurt my knee. And I remember just standing there, you know, just literally tears coming down, mm-hmm. like, you know, like, this is it. You know, and I start questioning, like, man, is this how far, you know, I'm going to go?
Yeah, you get right there, and it's like, damn.
I let my family down. You know, I started questioning my goals, my plans. You know, and it was a tough time, because it was, like, dark moment, because you're almost to the NFL line draft. And you're
knocking on the door.
Yeah. And you're getting hurt. You're letting everyone down. But it goes back to what I said about control what you can control, right? About having that mindset that I always call it iron mindset. Like, no matter what it is, like injuries, you cannot control injuries.
You can't.
It's part
it's
of
inevitable.
The game.
Yeah, it's part of the game. Exactly.
And I learned that the hardest way. Not in college, but you can recover back and then go, right? This is the tough.
Literally, like, 8 weeks before, you have to go do the NFL combine.
Yeah.
So do you look at now kind of how guys don't play, they opt out of playing in bowl games and all-star games? Because either way, right, sometimes it builds you, mm-hmm. it could build your stock, or sometimes if you get hurt, right, do you think guys shouldn't play in bowl games and they should just focus on the combine once they're already a top drafted mm-hmm. guy? Or do you think your job is to play football, so play football?
I think, is it Marvin Harrison who
did nothing this year, yeah.
I feel like that I'm supportive of that,
mm-hmm.
because you've seen enough film.
Yeah, you have
in college.
Need.
Yeah, that you need, that he going against, like, you know, top players, mm-hmm. and you're a football player.
Game.
Yeah, you're a football player. You're not a going out there in the combine. Combine is all about skills.
Yeah,
to get your numbers. But if you're doing your thing on the football field, and you know, some guys choose to do the combine because they want to get their stock up.
Yeah,
but he's already the only thing you can do now is mess up,
yeah,
which is your, like, they're going to know your 40 yard dash. But you know, 40 yard dash is a whole different, you know, mm-hmm. it's not no pads, no helmet, you know, and a lot of people are doing well in the game. So for me, if I were to do it all over again, I would have gone that route,
yeah,
because you know, you already seen enough film.
There's not much else you can really do, right?
But I was just hungry enough that my mindset.
I want to be the best. So I'm going to go compete, right?
Compete, yeah.
And I see that nowadays, right? And I tell the kids, like, for me, I was a guy who had to go to combines. I had to do that stuff. I was an undersized linebacker. So it worked for me because I was able to, I knew I was a combine tester. So I knew if I go there and perform, my stock's only going to go up, right? Yeah. I'm training for the 40, so I know I'm prepared to run it. Yeah. I'm training for bench. So, like, for me, I love to go to those things. And like, if you're a 5-star recruit coming out of high school, you don't need to do those things. There's only 25 5-stars, right? Yeah. That's why you're there. You're the perfect specimen. But for a lot of the guys who are trying to build their stock up and get a bigger offer, or try to climb the rankings in the draft process and things like that, right? The all-star games could help you do that. that the combines could help you do that. But if you're already a top first round draft pick type of guy, right, you've already have, if you're a first round guy, most of the time you have so much film on the guy.
Yeah.
Right. You already have 20 to 30 games underneath your belt. It's like, what else more do you need to see? Exactly. You already have my numbers from spring at my college of what it looks like. So yeah, I agree with that also. If you're a for sure guy that's already a five-star coming out of high school, or if you're a first round draft pick, yeah, there's no point in that. Just take care of your body and the longevity, you know, to make sure you can't make the club in the tub, right? Yeah. For the guys that are trying to climb those ranks and to improve their draft stock or in high school get more offers, the combine is something that will allow you to do that. All-star games will allow you to do that. You know, you could show, you could compete versus guys you might have not have competed versus in your league, or in your conference or things like that, where if I'm a DN and I'm, say, a three-star recruit and there's a four or five-star recruit in the All-Star game with me, if I'm able to go put good film versus this guy, my stock's now going to go up.
Yeah.
But if you're a five-star and you're getting beat by the three-star, your stock could only go down, you know?
Yeah.
That's awesome. So now you tore your meniscus. You can't do the NFL combine now, right? Can't run the 40. You can't do that. Do you get surgery? Like, what happens after that? Or do they just want you to let it heal naturally? Or
I did surgery.
Okay.
I did surgery in Pensacola, Florida, a week later. Mm. I think they let the swelling down a little bit. And after that, they did the surgery by Dr. James Andrews. And and also after that, like going back to, you know, to the combine, I knew one thing was just, you know, recovery and make sure my knee's right. But I'm going to the combine for interviews and also the bench press.
Beat the bench press record. The bench press.
And I knew from after my first year in JUCO that I'm going to beat the bench press record.
Yeah.
I don't care what the number will be. I will make sure I'll beat it. It's just one of those things, like you have goals and, you know, that was
always something for me in high school. Obviously you didn't do it. Back in the day, the Nike camps used to have the 185 bench press, right? And I broke the high school bench press back in the day with 47 reps. So for me, that was something. Looking at college, it's like I want to go and try to get, you know, as many bench press as possible. I ended up doing 39. And before you broke it, what was the number?
44?
About 45. 44, right? Yeah. And then you ended up hitting what?
49.
Yeah. Did they not count any, or they counted all of them? Or
they counted all of them, but the thing was I didn't know I was at 49. I lost count.
Yeah, at that point,
because they were tapping your thigh, saying all the way up, and the guy was yelling all the way up.
It gets distracting,
and everything's just pressure. A lot of, you know, head coach, everyone's general managers there watching. I've never been, you know, under so much pressure doing bench press.
Yeah,
but I remember getting into 47. I to 49, I thought I was at 47.
Yeah.
So I was like, you know, what's the difference going from 47, 48? And then now the big question is, you couldn't get one more?
Yeah.
You couldn't get one more? If I knew I had 49,
I could have got one more.
I would have rest a little bit and just bounce it off my chest get 50.
So when you were preparing, obviously you're hurt. All you could do is prepare for the bench press. Was it like an everyday thing? Because people don't understand. Doing the 225 bench press, it's not something you could just go and, hey, I'm strong, I'm just going to go do it, right? You could bench 500 pounds and you don't have the endurance or conditioning to do the 225 bench press. You could hit 30 even though you're that strong, right? It's a skill, it's an art. You have to be able to count those reps, know when you're fatiguing, know when it's, okay, I got five in me, I got three in me. Ooh, here comes the two.
Yeah.
Now it's one, right? Uh-huh. So it takes a really good skill set to do that. So when you're out there training for it, was it something where it's like, this is what we need to get? And was it like an everyday thing for you?
It was, I benched like every 3-4 days I benched. And it was like, I just went through my little routine. But it goes back to, you know, what you're saying. It's like Usain Bolt running 100 meters cannot go and run a 400 meters.
Yeah, exactly. Right?
And I've had guys afterwards benching like 600 pounds saying they're going to break my record. And I was like, hey.
Good luck, bro.
I mean, I hope so. Yeah. But, you know, they go out there and do like 31 reps.
For sure. They always
fall short. It's just different, yeah. And only that, I don't know if you noticed, but they did the, and still now they do the clean bar. Not the
one that moves?
The one that moves. Ooh, the one that snaps. That's what
tough.
I had.
Yeah,
I had that's to, tough. It snapped like this.
Mm-hmm.
So that's tough to do a bench because it's like...
You're constantly off. Yeah.
Everything, yeah.
Stability, you're trying to hold it. Yeah.
So it was, and I had my own little routine, which I did back when I was in junior college.
Yeah.
Same routine. When I went to Velocity, they're trying to teach me all this stuff. I was
don't
like,
mess with it.
I already have my numbers. I'm going to crush it. And I remember warming up to the comp right before I go to do the bench press. It was my turn. I remember warming up and I put 5 plates and I did 1 rep.
Yeah.
So I did 3 plates, 4 plates, 5 plates, 1 rep. And everybody was like, this guy's showing off. But this is my routine.
My routine
because by the time I'm dropping out of that 2 plates, it's going to feel like so paper. It was like,
boom, bouncing to clink, 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 clink. Yeah, because, right, the 5 plates, yeah, boom, 1 rep. A lot of guys I see, I know that they don't know what they're doing if they're doing a ton of reps and warm-ups.
Yeah.
You're just already getting lactic acid in your triceps, exactly, right? Yeah. And so many people don't understand, in order to have a big bench press, you have to have a big back.
Yeah.
Right? Yep. Yes, you're using your triceps and your chest, but all that power is coming from your lats and your back to really explode that thing through, right? So now you beat the bench press record, right? It's all over the place. Where's your mindset at knowing that you can't do any of the other combines? Did you think you weren't going to get drafted? Did you think teams were going to take a shot on you? Like, obviously, you did a great job breaking, like, the only thing we could evaluate him off of is interviews and his bench.
Yeah, his bench.
And I'm sure you crushed both of those.
Yeah.
Right? So now it's like, okay, it's a waiting game now because the combine ends late February, right? Early March. Now you have March, April, right? So you get drafted. Yeah. Where was your mindset during that? Well, obviously, it's still a tough time because you're questioning yourself and you're trying to figure everything out, right?
So part of the biggest thing was staying healthy, being able to recover from my right knee. Surgery so that I can get back on the field, because they had the pro day at Oregon State and I went to the pro day, but just to support. And I hosted my own pro day
a little bit later.
And then when I did that pro day, I still remember I wasn't really fully healthy, but everyone knew that, everyone, you know, and
because it takes so much time, not only just to get your meniscus back right, but condition your body, right? Your legs, your conditioning. If you can't really do that because you're just getting your knee right, you have to go out there and have to still do a pro day. That's tough, right? What day did they host that pro day?
I would say it was like about 3 weeks before the draft.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you tore your meniscus early January. Mm-hmm. Meniscus is usually, what, 6 to 8 weeks?
6 to 8 weeks,
So you had January, February, really. Mm-hmm. So we're in March now. So now you're kind of, okay, getting back. So pretty much you had maybe a month.
Yeah.
A month to train.
I think about a month from you know, getting on that treadmill, you know, getting
the air compression.
From that to, like, full speed.
Yeah.
Oh, man. And you got to do change of direction, all that. It was tough, and, you know, endurance, everything. It was like, it was really, really tough because I've never had injuries. I never dealt with injuries, but it's part of the game that you gotta deal with.
And it makes you mentally tough. So understanding how to go through the adversity to kind of work yourself out of those dark moments, you know, and those are a lot of adversity things you'll deal with, obviously, in the NFL also, you know, injuries are inevitable. So now draft day is here. Where were you at?
Oh, man. I was in California. I was up in, gosh, was that Palo Alto?
Okay.
Yeah, I was in Palo Alto. I remember it was my mom was working for a lady, you know, her job, because she's still keeping her job. Because same job that when we came from the islands, we didn't want to do anything big or whatever. Mm-hmm. So I ended up just asking the lady, hey, can we come to your house and host my draft party there. She was honored because we had a bunch of friends, family.
That's cool.
Right? And it was like, it was special to me because that lady, her name is Barbara. It was like,
yeah, of course. Yeah. That's cool. So what were your agents saying? Did they think you were going to go first day? Did you kind of set up first day and watch the draft, or were you still at that point like, okay, I'm probably falling out of the first round?
Yeah, it was one of those things, like it was late first round or, you know, early second round. And obviously, I did not go in the first round.
Yeah.
And
what D tackles went over you?
I don't know.
You remember
I
or
like,
no?
It get to a point like, you know, you start to forget, and I never made it a big deal.
Yeah.
You know, to where it's like, oh, I know how many D line went in front of me or how many draft picks.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, I just got to be my better self.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I got to get better myself. I'm not competing against
anybody else. Yeah.
Because my better self, if I can leave it out on the field, you know, that's all you can do. There's nothing honestly. Else. Yeah.
And it's such a strong mindset to have, but it's so hard, you know, because you just got evaluated by 32 teams. Everyone's picking and poking at you.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone's trying to figure stuff out, you know, and even when guys get to college or the NFL, they try to figure out depth charts to this and that.
Yeah.
And that's what kills you. You know, all you could really focus on is going out there and doing your job to the best ability every single practice, every single day.
Yeah.
And if you could really keep that mindset, which is really hard to do because a lot of guys try to figure things out.
Yeah.
And that's just so much wasted energy in the wrong place.
Exactly.
Right. Just focus on yourself, control what you could control. And when you do that, you know, you could really have success by controlling those things. So now we're at the draft. Who ended up drafting you and kind of how that whole thing worked itself out?
So I remember talking to did I visit Chicago? I had my visit with the Eagles, and they were the 54th pick. Right?
I just got
and they I remember them took offensive lineman in the first round, and I thought they were going to take me because Eagles was my favorite team.
Yeah.
Growing up. So they ended up.
Was Casey Matthews a part of that group? Did he get drafted
there? I
think so. Yeah, he was that 2011 group, right? Because you're Cam Newton's class, right?
Yeah.
There you go.
And they were 54th pick, and Chicago traded, I forgot who they traded, in front of the Eagles and took me in the 53rd. So they lost, I think they lost their third round pick for that. But it was like, I remember getting that call from Chicago, Rob Marinelli. Man, it was like
wow, what a special moment.
Going from man, it's like, you know, thinking back to that time, man, like from Tonga, from nobody knowing you to like, you know, all your struggles from Kansas, you know, Utah, you know, obviously the junior college,
lonely
people that doubting you.
Yeah.
And you go to Oregon State, you go, it's like roller coaster, right?
It is a roller
coaster. Because you went up to almost to the highest, you drop because of injuries, right? Or you low here the whole time and you get six string defensive end, D tackle, people doubting you, you know, get a scholarship. So all those things, like good and bad and hard work, sweats, you know, everything, just like, man, it was a big relief. Because getting drafted second round, I never knew I was going to get drafted second round. I was just trying to make it to NFL any way I can. But it was like I was, you know, projected to go top. And then second round, it was the biggest blessings for me and my family. You know, I remember getting that call and I was just, you know, tearing up because I told my mom, you know, this is all because of you.
Yeah, she took a risk and really sacrificed a lot. And just for your whole family, you know, it's life changing, you know, and that decision your mom made, right?
And then for kids out there who's like, you know, in the process of like, it's a long process.
It is.
And is you got to have patience. You got to have that, you know, got to keep that grind and you got to keep working hard because you just, you know, it's like you're depositing all that hard work and dedication, you know, and one day it will pay off.
Yeah.
You know, control what you can control and just keep going, you know, because someone out there will watch your film. And you better put that best film, even if it's 8 reps or, like you said, 50 reps, because they watch everything. They watch your lowlights and your highlights. So if you're out there thinking that they just you're making your highlights, but you walk half of the other, you know,
the
walk to
players,
the huddle or walk to the ball, or loafing, they call it loafing, then you already know how they're going to grade you.
Mm-hmm.
So your film is your resume. Just do your best because someone out there, a team out there will believe in you. Take a chance on you and you
don't need everybody, right? You just need one team.
One team.
So many kids are caught up right now and posting offer 10, 20, 30, 40. And it's like, that's all cute and stuff like that. But really, really figure out where you want to go. What coach do you like? Build a relationship with that coach.
Yeah.
And don't just do it for the hype. Like, you're a perfect example. All you needed was one school.
One school.
Right? You got one school for high school. You have one school in JUCO. You have one school offer you. Which led to becoming an NFL draft pick and literally changing your whole life, which is amazing, right? What a great story. and now you're getting drafted. So the people who don't know how the draft works, like once you get drafted, what happens there, right? Do you fly out there immediately? Do you kind of, how does that whole thing
work? So for me at that time, it was during the lockout year.
Yep.
So it was.
There goes another adversity. Yeah, adversity right there.
So you're training on your own until training camp, right? So for me, I just got drafted and then just training on my own. But usually you go, they have the rookie OTAs, rookie mini camp. And then after that, you go into OTAs with the group, with the team. And after that, you go into the mini camp, going to, you know, camp. But all those things that now the, you know, all the after the lockout year, it's a process for rookies. It's like you're going from playing in the senior year or your last year in college to training for the combine and getting drafted.
So much happens in 1 year.
Sheesh. Yeah, rookie minicamp, OTAs, you're just like no breaks.
Yeah, think all about gas. That. You finish your senior year in the fall. You move out, you sign an agent, you go to a new place for the combine training, you go to the NFL combine, you have all-star games, you get drafted, and it's like it's such a rapid pace that rookie in the NFL. And just another thing, right? I didn't know that. Like, you're a guy who came out in the lockout, right? So now you're even behind the eight ball more because you don't get to go and work out with the team immediately. Mm-hmm. You don't get to build a relationship with the coaches. You don't get to go to OTAs and things like that, where rookie minicamp, where you can really start getting your feet underneath you, you know? And that's just even bigger where it's like, dang, you just got tested so much from every part of the game and even to getting hurt to then getting drafted, then the lockout in the NFL. So now that the lockout, when did the lockout end? When you were able to actually go to your team?
Going back, when we basically when we had
was training camp. July or was it?
I think it was July, But, you know, going back to what you're saying is that a lot of guys get caught up with, you know, with the whole scholarship thing. You know, is everything that you, when you get a scholarship to go to one team, is because of what you've done in the past.
Mm-hmm.
You still got to go there and perform. You still got to go there, you know, and do all that. And then, you know, for me, it was like, I've gone through a lot of adversities in the past, you know, with the injuries and everything. For me, going through that lockout year, it was just another adversity.
Yeah,
it's like,
exactly.
I'm used to it. But the thing is now is like, you know, going from the level of high school where everything was easy, swim move, the O-line, to junior college, the same thing, right? To starting in Oregon State, things were a little harder, right? Everyone's faster, stronger. Now you're going to the league. That was like the biggest test for me because I'm going against
everyone's a dog.
Everyone there is no everyone is all American. Everyone is, you know, you're going at not just all American in college, you're going against Pro Bowl players, you're going against players that are hungry. And sometimes Pro Bowl players, they take it easy in training camp.
They do.
These are the guys that are hungry, they're playing like more, you know, all pro
trying to make the team,
making a team. So I'm going against those guys. And with no OTAs and mini camp, I don't know the playbook yet, right? You just line up and then you got to figure out where, you know, techniques and all that. It was like, man, you're just get thrown in the fire all over
you. You do. And you're starting from the bottom again. Yeah. So what was the hardest thing for your transition? Was it the speed of the game? Was it the size or was it the playbook?
It was all.
All of it, huh?
Because you going out there.
It's a lot at once.
At once. And you going, I was in Chicago, it was 120. Oof. 120 humid with, humidity was like, man, I remember that. I almost quit that because everything was like, my knee was still bugging me.
Yeah, and you're getting the injury,
And I did not have a good, good camp.
Mm-hmm.
I basically like, oh man, I made it now, but it's like, it's you know, I know it's hard.
It's easy to get on the roster. Yeah. It's hard to stay.
Hard to stay.
People don't get that.
Because I was already talking about, like, you know, fans are talking about bust, talking about all this, right? But, you know, you get to that point where you're like, in, you know, the edge where you're thinking like, are you going to quit? But what I did was going back to my whys, you know, this is not, you know, I've gone through adversities. I'm here now.
Yeah.
Keep pushing, right?
And you were a guy that obviously was a strong guy and kind of some of the stronger guys I see who play in the NFL who could usually bully guys in high school and college.
Mm-hmm,
Really not say struggle, but they have to really trust technique now. Was that kind of one of the things that you went through where it's like, usually I could overpower people, but I really have to really start working on hands and technique and things like
that. Exactly. Because, and for offensive linemen, they're taught to be balanced, right? For defensive linemen, you're taught to get them off his mark.
Yeah.
And for you to do that, it's not just bull rushing, though, because they're stronger.
Yeah, they want to just sit down and anchor.
You can't bull rush a 330-pound lineman, and I'm like, you know, 290. You can't do that every time. Yeah, you know, you gotta trust, like you look at Aaron Donald, right? He has his skills level. His toolbox is crazy, right? Because
so what makes him so special? Is it the speed to power and then the moves off of that?
Like, it's just his hands and his techniques.
It's just so violent.
It's so violent. When he hit that. And his speed too. Everything.
Everything.
Basically everything.
He's undersized, and it's like, how is he just dominating so many people? You know, and
he ran a 4.6.
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
4.5, right? But running around and be able to use, you know, speed. Sometimes you're like, a lot of guys think that your power comes from, like, you know, your just your brutal strength and your weight. A lot of people think, oh, he's 320 pounds, you can bull rush or whatever. He's pretty strong when he does bull rush because he's fast.
Yeah.
Right?
It's when like, get off.
Yeah, speed to power.
Speed to power.
So for him, every time he go against that offensive lineman, his goal is to get them off balance.
Yeah, get him to move, open
and
his hips.
And he does that the best. JJ Watt, him, they do that the best these past, you know, decades. So
yeah. That's awesome. So kind of learning the technique, learning the system, going through the injuries. Now you're here. How did you do during preseason? Did you ball out? Was it still kind of figuring things out?
Figure things out because...
Who was in front of you on the depth chart?
I remember it was Anthony Adams and also Anthony Adams, Matt Toina, and there was Amobi Okoye. We had one of him and Henry Melton.
I've heard
of him.
And you were playing 3-5-1, or was it just more interior?
Three and nose. I played both. Because remember, he's trying to figure me out because I was late with minicamp, right? OTAs. I don't have enough film to prove that I can be even a backup.
Yeah.
So I was third string.
Were you were they a forefront or a three?
4-3.
So it was 4-3.
Yeah.
So what'd you like playing in better? A 4 or 3 front?
4.
Because you Redskins were what, a 3 when we were there?
Yeah. So they're more like gap control.
Yeah, for sure.
But this one you just go. Mm-hmm. And the linebackers can play, you know, I play with Brian Urlacher, with Julius Peppers on the side, so Lance Briggs. So I get to play and learn from these guys. Sure. Right? Charles Tillman in the back, the peanut punch.
Yeah.
So when
did you end up starting? Like, when did you get your first start? Was it second year when things started coming together?
Second year. So this is a cool story too. My first four or five games, I did not play.
Mm-hmm. Special teams?
No, did not play special team either. So I basically just didn't suit up, right? Because they have.
So you're on the 53, but not the 46.
Yeah.
Okay.
So they have first string, and then we always have three defensive line D tackles. So for me, it was like just waiting for someone to get hurt, and then I go up, right? Or someone to not perform well.
Yeah.
But remember, this is all professional.
Exactly.
They are going to, as long as they stay healthy and do their job, they're going to play, right?
Always say it takes a little bit of luck and timing to get on the field.
Yeah. Yeah. And then one of the D line got hurt, so I came up to be a second string, right? And we're playing against. So when I grew up, remember I told you I'm an Eagles fan?
Yeah.
My favorite players was Donovan McNabb.
Mm-hmm.
Played Madden, everything, right?
For sure.
And so when I played my first game ever in the NFL playing against the Minnesota Vikings, my second play, I going in, I think it was the 12th plays total in the game. So I going in there, someone, you know, I was tired and went in there. My second play, made a move. Went out and sacked the quarterback for safety.
Who was it? Was Brett Favre the QB at that time or no?
It was Donovan McNabb.
Donovan McNabb. That's so cool.
My favorite player.
Wow.
And I remember that 1-2 minutes after that, it was like Urlacher got there too, but he was just like a split second late. So they awarded me the sack because he just gave himself up.
Yeah.
I beat my guy clean. It was literally like about to be a duel.
Think of that. Stephen Paya. Brian Urlacher and Donovan McNabb all in the same play. What a good group of guys, man, to be around.
I remember getting up and I everything was just blacked out. I did not remember.
You don't hear nothing. Anything. Yeah, it's just
it was like this moment is like, man, is this real? Is this a dream? Because usually those are dreams. You wake up and you're like, oh, it was a dream, right?
Yeah, for sure.
But you're living it. It was, man, that was like, I remember telling that story because for guys, like, you know, they don't understand when you, you know, you keep working hard, right? You're going to end up playing against your role models. You're going to play against guys that you look up to, right? And you know, obviously for me, the biggest disadvantage I could ever think for, you know, a player, except I know Jonan Mailata, you know who he is, right? Mm-hmm. Left tackle for the Eagles. Guys like him who hasn't played a single down before the pros.
Yeah.
Right? Getting picked on the
draft.
That was
the guy who came in from like New Zealand or something, right? Yeah, and they did the whole story on him.
So stories like him, you know, stories like mine going, I went through the, you know.
Journey,
right? There are guys here, there are kids here in the United States who are already living the American dream of, you know, with the mindset of like, you know, just do it.
Yeah.
Just go for it because you have all the tools. You will have all, you know, the guidance and, you know, with Winner's Circle, you know, what you're trying to, you know, the core values of Winner's Circle. Man, guys like that, that kids have all those tools that all they can do is just
possible,
resource. Yeah. And all they can do is just go for it.
And I always tell the kids they have to maximize the opportunity. I know it seems normal for the kids here to what they have because they're just normal. It's used. Mm-hmm. They're used to it. But if they really take advantage of the opportunity, everything that's here and the resources, like guys like you helping coach these kids at Winner's Circle this week. And it's like, there's so much wealth of knowledge here that they can learn from, but they still have to want it, right? They have to sacrifice a lot. Like I sacrificed so much of my life, friends, Thanksgivings, Christmases, you know, same thing with you, sacrifice not being with your parents for years, you know?
Yeah.
But if they're willing to sacrifice and they're willing to put in the work, I know it sounds cliche, but hard work does beat talent. And the only thing that follows hard work is results, right? And it's going to be highs and lows and it's a roller coaster lifestyle the whole time. But the ones who can continue to push through that and fight through adversity, there is the light at the end of the tunnel, right? So now you're in the NFL. When did you get your first, like, when did you like, okay, I'm here. The team trusts me. They're buying into me. I'm starting now. What kind of year did that come about?
The following year, the second year. And I remember getting tested. It was the biggest. I got awarded the starts position. And on my way, we're going to play Green Bay at Green Bay.
Yeah.
You know, tough environment. Before I get there, I got food poisoning.
Wow.
Because of bad steak or whatever. And I remember sitting there getting all the IVs and everything. I didn't think I was going to play. But part of me was like, man, what another adversity?
Adversity again? Yeah.
Like that I have to go through.
I finally get the starting spot. Now I freaking get food poisoning. Like, what the heck?
Yeah. And I remember the coach came up to me and like, you know, cussing me out. You really want to start? Do you really want to start? Oh, man, that just sinked in. You know, everything was just like, you know what? Do I really want this? Yeah. I never let the backup, because remember, he got benched. I started.
Yeah, you never want to
give
him
back.
And I
didn't want him to give him another chance. So I ended up started. I did okay. But, obviously the following game, I played healthy.
Yeah.
But this time, it was like the best test that I could, you know, gonna get, because I've gone through a lot of adversity before, and just another adversity, and not just because you get drafted, just because you're gonna go through adversity where you get hurt, you know, food poisoning, all these things, you know, coming in, just stop you from, you know, from your dreams or your goals. You just got to go through it.
Amen. So you finish up, you end up being a starter at the Bears, right? And then you were there for what, 4 years?
4 years.
Four years, and then you signed a big contract with the Redskins.
Yeah.
What was your Redskins experience like?
For the Redskins,
more adversity?
A bunch of adversities. Going into to the Redskins, I there were like two or three teams that I chose, you know, because of my first contract, with the Bears was done after my fourth year. And I chose the Redskins because...
was it depth chart? Was it scheme? Was it kind of what...
Yeah, it was both. It was both because I was promised a lot of things, yeah. You know, from standpoint, I knew the coach. I knew especially their D coordinator at the time, Joe Barry. He kind of knew Rob Marinelli, you know. So in the style of like just Marinelli to Joe Barry, I go in out there, I play three technique or five technique, which is still just getting off the ball. Right? Same thing. For sure. And going out there, just a lot of miscommunication with, you know, coaches, players, and things like that. And, you know, to me, it was like an environment I wasn't comfortable.
Used to, yeah.
Yeah, used to.
And that's the hardest thing when you are in the NFL, and kids will learn about this in the transfer portal also. Once you're comfortable with somebody or in a system or a town, right, you have a good routine again. The hardest thing is starting all over again, right? The hardest thing is, I always say, the hardest transitions are being a freshman in high school, a freshman in college, a rookie in the NFL, or going to a new team, because now you don't know the structure, the schedule, the system, right? And us as athletes, we're very structure oriented. Like, we know what we want to do. Yeah. We know where we like to eat. We know kind of the people in town.
So
whenever you see guys go from team to team, right, that's very hard to do because it's always starting over again, right?
Exactly.
Being comfortable in the locker room, being comfortable with your coach, you know, learning a system. So as you transition from the Bears to the Redskins, right, you go through that again. It's a whole new place now. You go from Chicago to freaking Virginia, right?
Ashburn.
Ashburn, I know. I sit at the dang hotel. So that's when we first met, right? You're on the team. You're the new guy that they signed from the Bears. I was just a free agent guy. I came from the Chiefs, ended up signing as a fullback there. And even when you're there, you're always working. You're always grinding, right? Yeah. You weren't really, I wouldn't say – right, you really, I want to say vocal, but you were just always working, right? You just kind of did your own thing, and you just was head down. You were a vet. And obviously, I ended up getting hurt that year, finished my career. After the Redskins, you went to?
Browns.
So you went to the Browns, and then you ended up where? Where
was your life? Cowboys.
So how many years did you end up doing in the NFL? So you played for four teams, and over how many years?
Seven years.
7 years?
Yeah.
What was your best experience team-wise? Was it the Bears?
Bears and also the Cowboys.
Cowboys also.
Even though I only played four or five games with the Cowboys.
Yeah.
But it was the Cowboys, it was just different because I knew that I've been on that roller coaster ride.
Yeah.
Right? And I remember getting into the Cowboys, I was third string, you know, and obviously been bouncing around. Obviously met my wife when I was with the Cowboys.
That's awesome.
And met my beautiful wife. And also, for me at that time, third string, and also fighting back to my during training camp, going against O line. You've heard about the O line, the Cowboys,
right?
With Zeke, and so I'm going against these guys every single day.
Yeah,
right. In training camp, and that's the way I earned my starting spot because I'm over here beating them in one-on-ones, you know, and the running, you know, running game.
For sure.
All these pause drills that we're doing. And back to Marinelli again, who drafted me, right? Third string. That's he didn't crazy, give it to right? me easy, right? Yeah. So for me to go on that step-by-step again and going from third string to a starter with the Cowboys, and obviously retired four games later because of my knee, I couldn't do it. That was the reason why I kind of like – It was a stamp in my career because, you know, I going through in that adversity again, went through the same thing. It was like, I knew it. It was like basically on my last year because my knee was, I thought I was going to play the last year and finish, but it didn't last because I could barely walk and do talking about leaving everything on the field. And I did not want to, you know, going out there, let my teammates down by playing, you know, just playing just so I can get a paycheck or playing out there. And It was tough, but the Cowboys was one of I'll never forget.
And people probably missed this, but you said another coach who drafted you played for before brought you to the Cowboys, right? But earlier you said the same thing with the Redskins. You had a relationship with someone who got you there.
Yeah.
So the kids that are out there and the parents that are out there who are watching this, never burn a bridge. Right. You cannot burn a bridge because the 1% at the top is such a small circle, whether that's the top high school coaches, the top trainers, the top college coaches, the top NFL coaches. Coaches constantly bounce around.
Yeah.
And there will always go. They like they want to be familiar with who they're bringing in, right? Because they know your system. So if you're a guy who burns a bridge with a coach, this coach might be at three or four different teams in the NFL where he's never going to want to go and stand on the table for you, you know, but that just shows who you were as a football player, where every team you went to, you had a coach that you played for before, and they knew what type of guy you were. They knew what they're going to get out of you, where they're willing to bring you into that next team.
Exactly.
And I see so many parents right now, whether it's a transfer portal in high school or college, where they leave a team, they talk trash on the coach. It's their fault. It's this. Instead of just, you know, leaving on good terms, they want to go and throw those coaches underneath the bus. Yeah. And that's, for maturity wise, they got to grow up. Parents have to grow up. Kids have to grow up, because it's such a small world at the top. And everyone knows everybody. So you're either going to create opportunities for you down the road that you don't even know you're creating by who you are and your work ethic every day, or you're going to close doors on yourself before you even have an opportunity to go there, because your name crosses their desk. And it's like, nah, screw this kid, screw his parents, they're cancers, right? And I see that a lot at the youth and high school level, which sucks, you know? And for you to go and have so many people stand on the table for you just shows what type of great athlete you were and human being, you know? So I always say that there's two lives we live. There's our football career life, and then there's life after football, right? And we have to, we're reborn again. So now that you're here, you did 7 years in the NFL, you get hurt, right? Did you know you were going to retire, or was it kind of, or was it kind of just like, I just don't feel good. I can't perform anymore.
Yeah. Man, my goals was to play as long as I can.
Yeah.
If it wasn't for my knee, if it wasn't for a bunch of injuries that I had in my toes, I would probably still playing.
Yeah.
You know, because
physically you still look great, you know, but just one little thing.
Because that's all I knew.
Yeah.
My degree was football.
Exactly.
Got a PhD in football, you know, obviously, you know, we talked about, but it's just, you know, one of those things like
the game's retirement's undefeated. I always say the game is always going to end 100% for the time for everybody. Your career is going to end. No one plays forever, right? And did you have a plan when, obviously, you get hurt? It's kind of sparing. Like, you don't, obviously, no one plans for it. Did you know what you wanted to do after football? Were you kind of thinking about long-term stuff? Or was it, I burn the boats, right? I'm 100% football. I'm not worried about anything outside of football. Or did you kind of have other things that you wanted to do once your football career was over?
Everything was just happened so fast. With retirement, you know, at the age of 29, I did not expect to be retired at 29.
Yeah.
I thought I was going to retire at 34, 35, you know, have a long career. And obviously that's not what happened. But, you know, for me to go after football to figure out what I want to do, and, you know, things like that, it was tough because you're so into this football, in the football world, where everything is scheduled. Everything is, you're told what to do.
Yeah.
You know, I've been told what to do ever since I grew up, right?
For sure.
And you're told, you go here, go there. And then after you're done
to eat, when to go to sleep, right? Class time, workout time, what to wear.
Uh-huh. What time is meeting, what uniform you're going to be putting on, everything.
Yeah.
You're so scheduled to where after football, now you're trying to figure out, okay, what's another career? Everything, like you're saying, the second life started, you know, and you're trying to figure out again what you want to do. And then, you know, it took me a long time to figure out, you know, what I wanted to do, because I met my beautiful wife.
Yep. So this is 2017 you met her?
2017. Awesome. We got married 2018. We have four beautiful children.
It's awesome.
And, you know, just being a daddy and being, you know, with my kids, they kept me busy, man. Yeah. You know, it's like one of those things, like it's a different world, and it's just, you know,
completely different. Blessing. You can't even prepare for it, right?
And there are times I just forget all the things that happened in the first life, right? Yeah,
for sure.
And then now that they're growing, they're starting to, I'm getting older, right? Growing and trying to figure out what I want to do is now that I looking back in my life, how I've been going through adversities and things like that. Now I'm like, man, maybe I can help out kids.
Yes.
Maybe I can help out kids, you know, warn them about things that they're gonna, you know, they're gonna go through adversities. Mm-hmm. They're gonna go through, maybe teach them the techniques that I didn't learn until my fourth year in the league. Because that's what, you know, that's what I learned. I learned the best. My best year was in the fourth year in the league, because one of the techniques and all the coaches and the players that I learned from, right? It finally clicked.
Clicked, yeah.
So if I can get that to train these kids at third grade, very young age, it will be lights out by the time they're high school, right? That's for me now, it's my calling to help these kids. And
it's that spiritual money.
Spiritual money. And be able to feel good doing it and, you know, expect nothing in return. Because when they become successful, man, you're just helping out life. And then by that time, my kids would be that age.
For sure.
You know? And then, you know, be the father figure that I was in there, you know, when my dad wasn't around. You know, all these things that it took time for me to figure out my second life has been a lot of, you know, that daddy life, that daddy duty, you know,
sure. Yeah, it's being a husband,
being, you know, life is, you know, comfortable and everything, but still I gotta figure out what I can do. I played and retired 29. I still have, you know, the rest of my life.
So the last 6 years, kind of what have you been doing? You ended up moving to Alaska, right? Did you have all your kids in Alaska or were you, you had them before and then you moved there? How'd that kind of work out?
Yeah, we had our oldest in Vegas and then we had the rest in Alaska. Yeah.
What a journey, right? You go from New Zealand to Tonga to Kansas to Utah to Oregon to Chicago to Virginia to Texas to
Cleveland, Texas.
Cleveland.
Yeah.
Wow. That's crazy.
Vegas, man. Now Alaska. Yeah.
So now that you're a father, right? And now we're trying to, for you, right? During that time, you're trying to figure out who you were, right? Mm-hmm. And so many athletes struggle with that and go through a dark period. Was it, because obviously I always tell people, just because you have money and you have materialistic things and you have the family and the wife and all the things that you prayed for, what did you have still emptiness? Like, was there things that it's like, were you missing football? Were you missing the locker room? Like, what was the dark time that you were going through during that transition period? Was it being lonely? Was it just kind of being by yourself, or was it all just so new? It's like you kind of just feel lost.
When you wake up in the morning and you don't have anything to do, nothing scheduled, and you've been scheduled your whole life, right? Yeah. Doing the same thing over and over and over again. You know, money can't
fill the happiness, and some people think it will.
Yeah, and you know, when you use it right, you will get the happiness that you're looking for, but for me, it was just, you know, finding, that's why I getting more into working out, getting more into pickleball.
Pickleball. And trying to find a hobby.
Find a hobby so that you can stay in that competitive. Remember, we've been in this competitive nature and this culture.
And that's all we know. So when you lose those juices and you lose that adrenaline and you lose those endorphins. And I talked to so many football players or just even athletes. It's like, we didn't have hobbies.
No.
And people ask me like you got to get a hobby, Jordan. Like, and it's like, what do you, golf? I don't like, what do you want me to go do? Video? I my whole life has been around training, working out, structure. So I've always had something that it was like, I thought that was my hobby, you know, because it's work now, but that's what I've done since I was 8 years old.
Yeah.
Right. And it's like hobbies. Like I don't like trying to find hobbies. You know, I bought a PS5. I haven't played video games forever. Trying that as a hobby. Right now, being with my kid a lot and watch him grow up, I get fulfillment from that. Get fulfillment from obviously running my business and things like that. But even with me going through, I always say from 15 to 25, it was being the best football player possible. My career ended. Then from 25 to 35, it was building the best business possible. Mm-hmm. You know, now from 35 to where's next for me? And I always was chasing success and money and materialistic things because I didn't have those things. And then as you get them, you realize what's going to fill me up? You know, what's going to give me the hope and the peace once you start obtaining these goals and short-term goals that you have? And and for me, what's always really helped me was paying it forward to the kids and watching them grow and watching their process and helping that. And then kind of now as I go through this next thing, I get my new fulfillment off of doing the podcast, right? Yeah. This is like a form of therapy for me, right? I never got to discuss a lot of the things that I talk about. And it's really cool to see, since 2015, when I was with the Redskins, I haven't seen you since, 2000, what are we now? So almost 10 years, And we really didn't even have a relationship on the Redskins, right? No. Everyone's just there trying to do their own stuff. And it's crazy just through social media and through us being vulnerable and talking about kind of the process and understanding that we're all going through something similar after we finish our careers and trying to find that next thing. Mm-hmm. It was really cool to kind of see this movement happen because I didn't do it on purpose. You know, it was something that I felt like I personally needed to do that opened up so many doors of my buddy last week on the episode, Chris Galippo. I haven't seen him in 14 years. Yourself kind of reaching out to me and this wasn't planned. It's just like, hey, Jordan, I want to do something what you're doing out there for Winter Circle. I'm starting to train kids. I'm kind of getting over that next lifestyle, you know, I'm trying to figure out what the next chapter is for me. And you just kind of picked up and said, hey, I'm coming out here with my family. Can we talk and hang out and kind of show me what you do at Winter Circle? And I was telling Billy, it was crazy. It wasn't this week on the podcast. It was supposed to be something else. Mm-hmm. And to have you here and us just kind of fellowship and talk about kind of what that next chapter is going to look like in that next life after football. It's pretty special, right? And it's pretty special to run across people that I played with over the years and kind of hear your story and learn about the things you've gone through, because I feel like I could learn a lot from other people, right? You're a great husband, father, things that you've gone through in your life, right? And to find that motivation again, for me through other people, you know, is really special. And now we're here. I'm 35 years old. You're 35 years old. What do you want this next chapter to look like for you? Man. Where are you finding your passion, your purpose? Like, what is it you really kind of want to do?
Man, basically just for me right now is I want to upgrade every aspect of my life.
Right? Yeah.
And that starts with, you know, with home, my wife, my kids. And you know, with what my passion, what, you know, just staying busy. And for me right now is like, I've been the daddy duty and being the husband for the past, you know, 6-7 years,
vacation, things like that, doing the family thing.
And you get to a point like you're getting sick of, you know, doing the same thing over and over and over again. And with a purpose of, you know, I want to be the best dad, best, you know, husband. And right now is all I want to do now is, you know, doing that, but also like the calling that I was talking about, helping kids.
Yeah.
You know, there are things that I start now realizing that I was doing when I was playing that I didn't know that I was doing it.
For sure. Right? Yeah.
With I knew my whys, but I didn't know, it was just, you know, it's not going to magically happen, but you just keep doing it over and over again because you're so, you know, dedicated and you're, so for me now it's just be able to earn the spiritual money like we talked about and be able to do service to others, especially kids, that they grow up, you know, to the best shape of their life, you know, whether it's physical or mental, you know, spiritual, everything. And I'd be able to do that for myself.
Yeah.
You know, I do that
as much as we're going to help kids, right? We're talking about, you have a PhD in this and right. I run across a lot of athletes and it's like, bro, do what I'm doing. You know, it's awesome. And to be able, me and you talk about opening another location, whether that's here or in the Bay or in Utah, and be able to kind of have you use what you learned for the last however many years in sports to pay it forward to the next generation of culture is amazing, because there's only so many people out there that have the experience that you have, you know, and been on the journey you have, and what you could do for the next generation and push the culture forward. It's a great calling from God, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And so it's awesome to kind of to see you take that next step. It's been awesome to kind of get to know you again and have the conversations we have and to see how many kids you're going to impact right through training, whether that's D-line, whether that's opening a Winter Circle, whether that's through a school program or even having your kids go through your program, you know, it's priceless. And I'm super excited for your rebirth, right? As you can say, right? As we go through, we have the first life as a football player. But if you look at a 100-yard track, right, if we're done at 30 years old and we're running a 100-yard sprint, well, that we're only 30 yards into the race.
Yeah.
We still have, you know, so much left of that race to run. And finding your purpose and your passion and not being pleasure-driven, but being purpose-driven, there's a huge difference, you know. And purpose or pleasure-driven is, I want to make it to the NFL, get money to take care of my family, buy my mom or dad a house, you know. purpose-driven is waking up, excited to wake up, you know, to be able to go and not only change someone else's life, but the fulfillment we get from these kids by being out there to do what we love again, right? Helped me get over a lot of depression and anxiety and the things that I struggled with. Yeah. Because for me, if I don't have a purpose, it's like all we've known was purpose our whole life. Mm-hmm. All we've known is to work and to work for something and do something, you know? And a lot of the same attributes you have that made you special as a football player is going to make you special as you go through this next transition, right? As a coach, as a business owner, as a father, why you're such a great father, you know, we put all that energy and effort into something, something good is going to come about it. Mm-hmm. And I'm excited to kind of see where our relationship goes and to see you work with the kids that we have here at Winter Circle this week has been awesome. Yeah. You're going to do special things as you transition to this next chapter of your life. One thing is, if you could leave anything with the people who are watching this podcast or the kids, what would you say you want to drop the biggest gem on?
Oh, man. Goes back to, you know, what we talked about. I would say you got to get your whys. Know your whys. And the clearer the whys, you know, the easier the house.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to, then after that, you got to start going to, why not? Why not just go out there and be the best defensive line, or be the best athlete, be the best self, right? And now goes back, going to the third one is, why not you?
Why not you?
Why not you? Why not you be like the most outstanding person, best athlete? Because everything will fall into place when you do the right things. And when you know your whys, how is easy.
Yeah.
And, you know, obviously going back to, Kobe Bryant always say these, when you're obsessed with your job, obsessed with your craft, with everything that you're doing, obviously with the right techniques, with Winner Circle teaching all these things, but you still up to you if you want to be successful, right?
Yeah, you have to be obsessed with the
want
process.
It, you got
to
want it, and you got to be obsessed with all these things. Most successful athletes or even business people out there, they're just obsessed with their thing.
Yeah,
they talk about it 24/7 over and over again. Like for me now, I'm still walking by the door and I'm still doing rib moves.
Always, right?
Doing club, yeah. Right? It's like you're still in your head, like so that when you go into the game is easy because, you know, all you've been doing, you've been obsessed with your craft and do everything, right?
Yeah.
And then, you know, obviously after football, when you do all those things, you become successful. On your way, even on your way to, I think the biggest thing that you got to have too is gratitude.
Yeah.
You got to have gratitude. Wow. because when you started to be lost out there in the world of depression and anxiety and stuff, what has been helping me is gratitude. Knowing that my purpose here is bigger than just myself.
Wow.
I can think like I'm going to, you know, the end of the world. I've seen, it's unfortunate for me to know a lot of people that I played with, you know, their life ended right before they 40, yeah. Around the age that we're going to, right? 35 to 40, I've had five friends, you know, that I know, not friends, but I know.
Yeah, and I talk about this a lot. A lot of our guys that are 30 to 40 are dying. And it's like, why, what's going
because
on?
Because everyone think that life is over. But when you have your purpose, when you have gratitude,
you
know your whys, like you have, okay, your turn is over now. Okay, don't think that your life is over. You have your kids going up, right?
Yeah.
For me, that was the biggest thing right now is my kids. And also, I cannot wait for my kids to get older. I'll help as many kids as I can.
Yeah.
And for me to do that and to wake up every morning and go work out and work on myself working out and then be the best husband, be the best dad to my kids and be the best coach and best, you know, everything that I could ever think of spiritually,
mm-hmm.
you know, finance, everything, you know, it'll follow it'll everything,
work
right?
Out.
Work itself out. But when you do all those things, man, what a life that you can live here on earth, right?
Amen.
When you exit, your kid's going to start talking about
me. Legacy. Right, leaving a legacy, man.
So for me, that's what I've been trying to figure out this past 6-7 years.
Yeah.
And I'm like, man, I have a lot of things that I want to teach the kids, right? And I won't just teach this year. I want to teach next year. I want to keep teaching them because the more kids I can help, man, that's like spiritual money, spiritual legacy, everything. And that's how I'm going to, you know, that's what my world, how my world will become fulfilled. And I appreciate everything you put me in this podcast, you know, just to share the message to the kids. And I feel like that the more we can talk about it, and the more we get, you know, plant that seed in their head, the same way I got planted that seed in my head back in the day, it'll be good for them. You know,
amen. I always say it takes one coach, one person to plant that seed, to help you water it. That could change your life forever. I had a coach, you had somebody who did it for you. And for the players out there, right? The guys who finished their career, understand, yes, like he said, your playing career might be over, but take all the same things that you learned in your life that made you a great football player, right? And understand, your identity isn't the jerseys, the uniforms, the stats, right? That your identity is who you are, and the work ethic and everything that you learned on your journey. Take that into your next chapter. And we see a lot of our boys that are dying and giving up on life and becoming addicts and things like that. And it sucks, because at one point in time, those people were so driven. They had so much passion. They got up for 6 a.m. workouts.
They had purpose. They had,
So don't lose your purpose. For all the vets out there who are done playing the game, find your purpose. Find your spiritual money where you could change somebody else's life and pay it forward. Last thing you want to do is go do something you're not happy for the rest of your life. And on the podcast, everything that I'm trying to get across is, right, to help the kids transition from youth to high school to college, college to pro. But even for my old buddies out there, a pro is life after sports. You know, what is your next chapter going to look like? And it's awesome having different guests on the show, from mental performance coaches to former players to everybody who has such a wealth of knowledge to share to everybody and the kids that are out there. So this is episode four. Shoot, we're rolling now. We're on episode four. We got my boy Stephen Pye on here. Amazing story on how he made it throughout his process. So make sure you guys continue to tune in, like, subscribe, share the videos, get the message out there to know that there's two different lives that you live, right? You have your athletic career and you have life after football, but it all starts with spiritual money, right? Doing it for the right reasons and finding your purpose and your why, and take the skill set that you had as an athlete and continue doing that in the next chapter of your life. So appreciate everybody watching. We're out.